Okay, I want to welcome you to this second of two lectures on belief after Darwin, Dawkins, and Dennett. I think many of you were here last week, and our format will be very similar. I think Kelly will speak first, then Steve, but we do hope to spend more time on the questions. One person emailed me this past week and wondered, you know, to whom was these lectures addressed? And it seemed to me, after listening to last week's, these two talks are addressed to those who, on the one hand, feel that evolution has eliminated or dispensed with God, and it is also addressed to those who feel that God dispenses with or eliminates evolution. So it goes both ways. And we're here really to think about this whole matter of what Darwin and Dawkins and the rest have said about evolution, and to think about what it in fact says about our faith and how to work these things out so that that we can be at peace with it. Okay, I think without any further words, I'd like to introduce you to Kelly Clark, who is professor of philosophy at Calvin College, and Steve Matheson, who is professor of biology, also at Calvin. So welcome, and thank you.
For those of you who are here last week, the main argument went something like this. I argued that if you already believed in God, your belief was okay, it was rational, it was permissible, and that evolution didn't count against your belief. It's still okay, your belief is still okay in spite of the truth of evolution. And Dawkins, of course, has argued against that. But I got a couple of email messages from people saying, but you didn't really say anything positive about why we should believe. You just said if you already did, your belief is okay, and you didn't need to stop if evolution were true. And I want to be a little more positive tonight. In part, I want to be more positive because of experiences people have told me they've had. I have them every now and then. Like, you know, do you ever wake up in the middle of the night and you think, you know, could it really be true that a perfectly good, all-loving being created the universe and cares about my welfare? Anybody ever have that experience? Me neither. So so I want to look at some positive evidence for the existence of God. This is a quasi-scientific argument. I'm going to use some science here. It's not going to be a God of the gaps argument, and maybe that issue will come up later. But it's one, interestingly, that modern science points to. But I'm going to show you that the conclusion that many people reach about this argument is one that's not really a scientific one, although science might start to point us or suggest something in the direction of the existence of God. There are other options. But whatever option somebody takes here, it's not really, we're not really embracing an option on the basis of scientific evidence. We're affirming something that some sort of evidence might point towards, but it's not something that the scientific evidence leads to. And I want to talk about some fundamental truths of physics. And I think fundamental truths of physics are really cool, like friction and gravity. Those of you that made it here tonight know that friction and gravity work. That's how you got here. Your car stayed down on the ground and the friction brought you here. I think friction and gravity are really great things. Here it is, Mother's Day. You know, you go and hug your beloved. Think if there were no friction and no gravity. You'd hug them, they'd squirt out, and they'd just fly away, you know? So friction and gravity are great things, and gravity is a really great thing. I hope Kenny's here, because I thought I'd use him as an example, because the great thing about gravity is that every body, the mass of one body, is attracted to every other body in direct proportion to their masses, but in inverse proportion to their distance squared. And that means, Kenny, that everybody is attracted to you, so there's hope. And the good news is, in case you lose the battle of the girth, the heavier you are, the more attractive you are. Okay, that's the great thing about gravity. Everybody in the universe is attracted to everybody in the universe. Now, here's an interesting thing about gravity, and I want to do it assuming the truth of the Big Bang, which I think is fairly well established in science, and I think provides an evolutionary model of the cosmos. And so not only do we have an evolutionary model, of how human beings came into existence and all the biological species, but I think Big Bang cosmology also assumes that how the universe came to be, at least how it is now, came to be through evolutionary processes. And the basic idea with the Big Bang theory is that at one time, all the matter in the universe was all squashed into one tiny little point. That point is sometimes called the singularity. Some people think it was really, really tiny. And the point is, if you take all the matter in the universe and you squash it all together, what you're doing is squashing all these little atomic particles, and some of them are positively charged, and there are other ones that are positively charged, and we know if we put positive and positive together, they want to repel each other. And so you've got all these really highly charged particles stuck in there. So this little thing is infinitely dense because all the matter is here all in one little piece, but it's also pretty unstable, and it wants to just explode. And it looks like it did explode. And I'm going to have it go off like it's going this way through time. And but it's exploded in every direction. You know, imagine a shotgun with all the pellets just going off. You got all the little particles of matter all being blasted off. And there are books written about what happened at, you know, the first second and the second second. I think there's one book called The First 3 Seconds, where physicists have extrapolated back as far as they can go with the laws of physics and tried to figure out what's going on here. But for our purposes, what happened here was some of these particles began to come closer and closer together, and eventually they form things like planets. And eventually we got a solar system and planets. So here's our little solar system, and here's the Earth. And our Earth goes around the sun at just the right distance. And on this Earth, if you don't mind, there's Kenny. Okay. So, and here's my point. It looks like the universe was precisely fine-tuned for the existence of Kenny. Well, human beings. And we'll just take him as the prime example. So how did this all work? Well, the interesting thing here, I get a little nervous. I'm just going to shuffle some cards every now and then. The interesting thing about gravity, I put a little formula up there. I put this up here. I think it's the acceleration of gravity. It's roughly something like this. A scientist can correct it in just a little bit. But the interesting thing is, would you mind holding these for me a second? You can shuffle them if you want, if you get nervous. If this doesn't go the way you wanted, you can start shuffling. So the interesting thing about the acceleration of gravity is the thing that attracts these little particles back to each other. They're heading off. There's an initial explosive force, and they're heading off, and they're heading off away from each other, and gravity is exerting some kind of pressure to bring them back together. And so gravity's bringing things back together here and here, and finally, it's the thing that holds our planet in orbit around the sun. Now, if the acceleration of gravity had not been exactly the value that it was, I put this here on your handout, if it had been only 1 over 10 to the 40th stronger, the universe would have collapsed too quickly for human life to evolve. So here's the point. If the explosive forces are going out like this and gravity was too powerful, and how too powerful, plus 1 over 10 to the 40th, if it had been that much more powerful, it would have sucked all of the matter back together. And if it sucked all the matter back together, then no human life. Now, I always think it's worthwhile seeing what 1 over 10 to the 40th is. Like if I flip a coin, do you have a coin? I meant to bring one. No? Are we paying you enough, Jack? A quarter will do. Here we go. Perfect. If everyone could get a quarter, my wife's right there in the second row. I forgot to get her a Mother's Day present, but I think a lot of quarters would be good. So the chances that it would come up heads is 1 out of 2, and the chance it'll come up heads 2 times in a row is 1 out of 4. So that's 1 out of 4, but this is 1 over 10 to the 40th. That's a really tiny number. What's 1 over 10 to the 40th? Well, it's 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 30, just a second. Okay. 38, 39, 40. That's that number. That's 1 over 10 to the 40th. So change it just a tiny bit, and you have too much gravity. And if you made it just a little less, then the particles would have just kept expanding and they wouldn't have contracted and there wouldn't be planets and there wouldn't be life. So plus or minus 1 over 10 to the 40th equal no human life. And that's gravity. We can get the same problem with the rate of expansion. That's the initial explosive forces. If they differed by 1 over 10 to the 60th, just hang on. There we go. Plus or minus 1 over 10 to the 60th. So imagine the shotgun here. You know, it takes off. If it had been just slightly powerful, this would have gone off. And if gravity had stayed the same, the matter wouldn't have been able to come back together and form planets and create conditions conducive to human life. And again, if it had been slightly less powerful, it would have blown out and gravity would have sucked it right back in. And again, no human life. So the rate of expansion has to be precisely fine-tuned. It had to be exactly right to create the conditions that were necessary for the existence of human life. And the same is true with the strong nuclear force. We're probably not so familiar with that one, but I think it's an interesting one. It's the most powerful force in the universe, next to love. Exactly. Love makes the world go round. But next to that, the strong nuclear force. The strong nuclear force binds atoms together in the nucleus. If you put protons and protons together, they want to repel. Okay, so you need a force that can overcome the electromagnetic force that wants to keep them apart. And so the strong nuclear force keeps... I got chemists here, so are you learning anything today? You're learning how mistaken I am. So that's the thing that keeps these protons together in the nucleus. Now, if it's slightly more powerful, you know, we got electrons running around out here. And if the strong nuclear force is more powerful, it will suck the electrons in. And if there's no electrons, then no hydrogen. And if no hydrogen, no water. And if no water, no what? Kenny. Okay? No human life. Again, so that value, the value of the strong nuclear force, has to be precisely fine-tuned to create the conditions that are necessary for human life. Can I have my cards back? Give it up for my lovely assistant, Jack. I got a couple quotes here from Arno Penzias. If you have your handout, you can take it out. Look at the top. It says this: astronomy leads us to a unique event, a universe which was created out of nothing, and one with a very delicate balance needed to provide exactly the conditions required to permit life, and one which has an underlying, one might say, supernatural plan. That's Arno Penzias, 1978 Nobel Prize winner for physics. Paul Davis, a professor of natural philosophy in the Australian Center for Astrobiology at Macquarie University, says, "It is hard to resist the impression that the present structure of the universe, apparently so sensitive to minor alterations in the numbers, has been rather carefully thought out. The seemingly miraculous concurrence of numerical values that nature has assigned to her fundamental constants must remain the most compelling evidence for an element of cosmic design." Now, I've given you three of these, they're called constants, that have to be exactly right for the existence of human life. But imagine instead how many there have to be. I've read variations from 4 to 68, but let's assume there are 52. It'll fit with my card thing a little bit better. So the idea here, and this is where the title of the fine-tuning argument comes in, the idea here is that all these physical constants are like a radio dial, or a radio with a lot of dials, and each dial has to have exactly the value that it has. Each dial has to be exactly fine-tuned for the existence of human life. And change it just a little bit, and no human life. And not just one thing, but all of them together. And so if you put the probabilities together, I'm going to throw out some big numbers here. I don't know what the right numbers are. And I don't think anyone knows exactly what the right numbers are. But the point is, the probability that all of the constants would have been exactly fine-tuned for the existence of human life, that probability is astronomically low. Now, astronomically low really underrepresents the value. I'll give you an astronomical number. The number of seconds in the universe is 10 to the 18th. That's the number of seconds in the universe. That's how old the universe is, 10 to the 18th. The number of electrons in the universe. I don't know where they get these numbers. Mark probably knows. 10 to the 70th are the number of electrons. The values that people have given for how improbable life is, Fred Hoyle, for example, who's an atheist, and he's calculated some figures, the probability that all the dials would be precisely fine-tuned for the existence of human life, he says, is 1 over 10 to the 100th, and I won't draw 100 zeros. But again, look at that number in comparison to this. I just read a Yale biophysicist. He gave a value of 1 over 10 to the 340,000th. So, I don't know, somewhere in between, pick a number in the middle. But the point is, it's not astronomically small, it's almost statistically impossible. That's the difference in the numbers. Now, suppose I take my quarter and I start flipping, and I want to know, so what's the probability that I'll get 100 heads in a row? Well, if I do it 100 times, the probability is almost zero if I just flip 100 times. So if I want to explain something, or if I want something to happen, or have a good explanation for something to have happened, if it's really improbable, the way to make it probable is to have lots of tries. So if I flip it a billion times, it's not so unlikely that I'll have a run of 100, right? So if you have something that's really improbable, if it happens a lot of times, if you get a lot of tries, then it's not so improbable. So we can explain the improbable if we have lots and lots of tries. So the physicists have offered some suggestions for how we could get lots and lots of tries. And one try is what's, I think I have it on here, is the squeeze-bang hypothesis, number two, and it probably should be the bang-squeeze hypothesis. So we'll take our universe here. Now there was a bang, and then everything went out, and here's our planet, and not to forget, here's Kenny. Okay, but prior to this, there was another universe, and it had different constants, and it likely didn't permit life. And prior to that, there was another one. And prior to that, there was another one, and maybe a really big, long one. Who knows? Maybe a short one. And this goes back infinitely. So if you have an infinite number of tries, even though it looks like it's statistically impossible, if you get lots and lots of tries, it's likely that you'll get one that permits the existence of human life. This one does work in terms of giving lots of tries. It's one I think that's really unlikely. And it's really unlikely, and no one should believe it, because the probability that after two or three tries, the acceleration of gravity is so weak it won't draw matter back together, so you won't get another try, or that the rate of expansion is too strong and it just blows things out and they don't come back together. The probability that in 1 or 10 or 20 or 50 tries that everything just blows out and doesn't squeeze back together, that probability is really high, like maybe 50-50. And so I think it's possible that there were an infinite number of tries prior to the existence of our universe. It's possible, but I don't think any reasonable person should accept it. So, what do some other people say? Some other people say that there are an infinite number of actually existing universes. An infinite number of actually existing universes. They're spatio-temporally unconnected to ours. I don't know, maybe we get there by wormholes. This could be like the Star Trek theory of these. But so here's our universe, and it contains life. But there are an infinite number, we can go in either direction, there are an infinite number of spatio-temporally unconnected universes. We just happen to be in one of those that permits the existence of human life. And again, we're trying to explain the improbable, and to explain the improbable, we need to increase the tries. Now, the only evidence for this, well, there's no evidence for this, except it gives it lots of tries. That's the only reason to believe it. Well, there's another one here, and that's God. If there is a God, if there is an omnipotent, omniscient, holy, good being who's the creator of the universe, who's interested in creating people capable of worship, virtue, love, and worship, if there's a God, then the probability that we'd have a universe with human life, I take it, is near 1, which is the highest value, or 100%. It's maximally probable. So, to me, it looks like we have this hypothesis, looks like it's still on the board, but we have no evidence for it. So I would call this not physics, I'd call it metaphysics. That's what we philosophers do. We do what's like beyond physics, what's beyond the world. And so this isn't any scientist that offers you this as an explanation of something that's really improbable, the existence of a universe that permits human life. They're not being a scientist, they're being a philosopher. And they're kind of guessing based on no scientific evidence whatsoever. Now, I have another guess. God is another guess. I'll give you a reason to prefer God in just a little bit. Another might be that it just all happened by luck, that everything just worked out. That's the first one. It had to have some value, the physical constants. If there is a universe, they had to have some value. And we got it on the first try. It was just luck. And so that one's possible, too. But I want to do my little card thing. So I shuffle my cards. My lovely assistant shuffled the cards. Now I want to get the cards out and see what kind of order we have here. So Ace of Clubs. Two of Clubs. Three of Clubs. Four of Clubs. Five. Six. Seven. Eight. Nine. Ten. Jack. Queen. King. Have I ever seen you before? Okay, so let's try this again. Ace of Diamonds. Two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten, 11, or Jack, I guess. Queen, King. Ace of Spades. Two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten, Jack, Queen, King. I've done this probably 50 times, and it's never worked before. They always come out random, so here we go. These are all in order. So here's my point. How many of you think by shuffling they came out in order? They had to come out in some order, right? And this is one of them. How many of you think it happened by shuffling? Well, I made the switch. Some of you probably saw it over here. If there's a being with sufficient intelligence, and it doesn't take much to put, you know, a deck in this pocket and a deck in this pocket. So I can't do any more complicated card tricks than this. But if there's a being with intelligence and power that wants this to come out in order, you can make it come out in order. And the same is true with the existence of human life. If there's a being with intellect and will and sufficient power, so it's got the ability and the desire and wants things to come out in a certain way, say the existence of human life, then it looks like, for all we can tell, human life is in the cards, pun intended. Okay, so I'm going to give you one reason to prefer the God hypothesis over the many worlds hypothesis. I don't think, here's my point about the cards. They could have come out in order by shuffling them. It could have happened. That is one of the options, right? So it could have happened. I would be the only one who could reasonably believe it. You would all be idiots if you trusted me. So I would be the only one that could believe it. But you shouldn't believe it because it's so improbable. And so I don't think anyone should believe that it just happened by accident. That there was one try and we got Kenny. Okay? No one should believe that happened by accident. It's possible, but I don't think it's reasonable. Squeeze bang hypothesis, I don't think is reasonable. Many worlds hypothesis, it's as reasonable as God. They're extravagant. Thinking there are an infinite number of spatio-temporally unconnected universes. It's really extravagant, but God is extravagant, right? Thinking that there's a being that's personal, that cares for us, that's the creator of the universe, that's extravagant. But I want to give one reason for preferring God over the many worlds hypothesis. And the reason is this. Some people, in fact, lots of people throughout human history, have claimed to have experiences of God. God enters into our world, breaks into it. He's not spatio-temporally unconnected. Now, maybe you've had them. And if you've had them, that gives you a reason, an independent reason, for preferring the God hypothesis over the many worlds hypothesis. And even if you haven't had one, the fact that so many people throughout human history have, and that in general we should trust people when they tell us about their experiences, that gives us some reason for trusting what people say. And if we trust what they say, we should trust what they say about their experiences of God. And that should give all of us at least some reason to prefer the God hypothesis over the many worlds hypothesis. You know, this is a really important issue. Whether or not there's a God is as important as anything there is. It probably determines how we view our eternal destiny, how we view our moral life, how we relate to one another. You know, it's really fundamental. And to make our best judgment on that, we've got to bring in all the evidence that we have. And so I brought in some scientific evidence, but I want to make this point. Preferring God here is not to prefer him as a scientific explanation any more than to prefer the many, many worlds hypothesis would be to accept that would be to accept a scientific explanation. It's metaphysics. It's what philosophers do. But you got to bring in all the information you have. And if you've had some experience of the divine, that gives you some reason preferring the God hypothesis over the many worlds hypothesis, which no one has had any experiences of. In fact, no one could have of. So I'll conclude here. I'll read Fred Hoyle and make one comment. A common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. That's from Fred Hoyle, the Plumian professor of astronomy at Cambridge University. It looks like, to me, we have good reason enough, to believe that there's a God, an omnipotent, holy good creator of the universe who's interested in creating people capable of worship, virtue, love, and worship. Okay, I'll turn it over to Steve.
Clap for Kelly while I'm getting all my stuff together. Or maybe, like me, you really hate being told what to do, in which case I'm sorry about that. Last week I talked a lot about explanation, and so when I first sat down to listen to Kelly, I was seeking an explanation for why he was wearing a jacket. And I think I have an explanation now. I want to start with two important cultural references. So the first is, I think, one of the greatest modern commentators on the world, someone named Calvin. Calvin has a friend, a little tiger named Hobbes. And perhaps you know Calvin. If you don't, I'm sorry, because then this next reference will be almost incomprehensible to you. But Calvin once said about the Big Bang that Kelly just described, what is it, I'm paraphrasing, but I'm going to get it mostly right, I think, here. What is it about scientists that they can imagine the entire universe exploding out of a dot the size of a pinprick, and they can't think of a name more evocative for it than the Big Bang? So I agree with Calvin on that one. I was not on the committee that named it, by the way. Calvin's proposal, if you've seen that comic strip, perhaps you've never forgotten his proposed name, which was the horrendous space kablooey. To which Hobbes said, yeah, that is better. Calvin said anything would be. Some introductory comments here. Last week, I was talking about explanation. And I probably gave you the impression that I thought it was preposterous to suggest that by assembling an explanation for something that you ruled out a role for God in it. I mean, perhaps I even mocked that position mercilessly and even disrespectfully. Those aren't words I've heard from anyone in particular, but I sort of had that impression afterwards. And so let me say to you that I did not intend in any way to give the impression that I think that questions or doubts of skeptics are silly, because I don't. You don't have to be an unbeliever to know there are questions and challenges that belief, and in particular Christian belief, have to confront and answer. That's true. And if you're a skeptic here tonight, and perhaps you're waiting, when are they going to get around to the hard questions? I don't think we've been avoiding them, but don't worry. I'm not pretending that there aren't hard questions. If you have kids, perhaps you've met Thomas the Tank Engine and friends, and you may or may not, if you have no idea what I'm talking about, this is even more bizarre than Calvin and Hobbes at Thomas the Tank Engine, little British train that talks, and all of his friends. And a weird cartoon TV show on PBS. I say weird because the first narrator was Ringo Starr, and then the second one was, does anyone remember who it was? George Carlin. That always kind of freaked me out. Is that George Carlin hosting a kids show? Anyway, again, if these are incomprehensible references, make sure you Wikipedia or Google them as soon as you get home. In any case, there was an episode where one of Thomas's friends, it might have been Henry, Percy, I don't remember who it was, but he was pulling a train up a hill, and he had previously mocked somebody for not being able to pull a train up a hill or something, and he was saying to himself, "It's not so easy. It's not so easy." So I just want to start off by saying there are questions here that their answers are not so easy. Richard Dawkins would do well to realize this about questions he raises and things he refuses to talk about as well. It's not so easy. Three, let me consider very quickly, mostly with the goal of planting interesting questions out there, three areas that I call trouble spots. Areas where at least someone says that that belief has a problem, or that belief is creating a problem for skepticism. Three trouble spots. The first trouble spot was raised in a question last week and is definitely worthy of a few comments by me. And that is, well, okay, Steve, perhaps the evolutionary explanation isn't in any obvious conflict with the idea of a creator God, but the story about how it happened might very well conflict with the idea of a creator God, and specifically the evolutionary story of common descent, descent with modification, perhaps through natural selection. Boy, it sure is hard to see that narrative lining up with these other narratives that Christianity tells. So there's one trouble spot. The biblical story of the fall of humans is difficult to reconcile with evolution, and in fact, as I'll tell you in a moment, never mind evolution, it's difficult to reconcile simply with facts about the ancient history of humans on this planet. A second trouble spot, or at least some people say, is that perhaps evidence of intelligent design is raising doubts about the theory that I told you last week has enormous explanatory value, and that it's actually bolstering belief, that people are finding, you know, evidence to support their belief through intelligent design. So maybe that's a trouble spot for you skeptics, I don't know. And then the last one, this is, you know, again, such a terrible book, it's just an embarrassment, but, you know, there's a couple arguments in here. If you extracted them, they'd fit on one of these sheets here. And, you know, one thing that clearly our friend the professor seems to think is that religion has actually been a net evil influence, and that in some way mitigates against belief. So we'll talk a little bit about that. So trouble spots. The story of the fall and of creation and so forth with regard to human beings. This whole intelligent design, brouhaha, and then Steven Weinberg's famous claim that, I think it goes something like this, for a good man to do good is one thing, for a bad man to do bad, but for a good man to do evil, that takes religion. I think that's, I got the quote mostly right. Okay. The biblical story of the fall of humans, which is, I hope you know, central to Christian orthodoxy, is difficult to reconcile with evolution in ancient human history. First of all, the basic story, if you haven't heard it, God creates a couple of humans, a man and a woman. He puts them into a garden. He gives them instructions. They fail. This creates what's called the fall. It introduces death, among other things, into the world. They're banished from that place, and they go on to spawn Kenny and everyone else in this room. We inherit from them our sinful nature, and this is the story. The fall of the entry of sin and death into humans is a central event in the narrative of the Christian faith. There's no question about it. That's the basic story. Well, it gets a little complicated because centuries ago, long before anyone would have even dreamed of an ancient earth or of common descent, someone thought, well, you know, we ought to be able to figure out exactly when this happened. because the Bible's got these stories in there in them and that occasionally contain a genealogy, a family tree. So-and-so beget, so-and-so beget, so-and-so beget, so-and-so beget, so-and-so beget Jesus. Those are the purposes of those genealogies. And so, you know, if we carefully look here, we ought to be able to work it back and figure out how old the world is and when the fall happened. You know, the guy who did this, is he was a bishop named Usher, and his name is now a sort of a part of a rogues gallery of the abuse of science by religion. Stephen Jay Gould has actually famously said, hey, the guy did the best science he could in his time, which was quite a long time ago. The point is that if you do that, you come up with, does anyone know the date? 4004 BC. Do you know what day? Why is it Tuesday? October 23rd is the day. I don't remember what time it was. Noon or midnight? It was noon. All right. We have some experts in the crowd, apparently, on the Archbishop's work. Okay, now, of course, if I tell you that I have concluded through my religious belief that the Earth came into existence in 4004 BC, you will tell me, you don't even need to mention evolution, to tell me that science is going to beg to differ with that conclusion. Well, Benjamin Warfield, one of my heroes, here's one of his books here, a Princeton theologian, a good Calvinist of the previous century, begged to differ, said, no, based on the work of others, his colleagues at Princeton, he said, that genealogy work is a joke. There's big, giant gaps in there, and in fact, this 4004 BC thing, no, the Bible doesn't teach that at all. He said, in fact, the question of the antiquity of man, today we would say humans, is accordingly a purely scientific one in which the theologian as such has no concern. In other words, he was saying, who cares about that? Usher was wrong. We don't know how long humans have been here. If somebody says 120,000 years, no problem at all. I think you'll realize that doesn't solve all of our problems. We've got an additional problem here. But let me just tell you that a colleague of mine, a former colleague of mine, now retired, Dave Young, I first read one of his books when I was at Park Street Church in Boston. It was one of the reasons I found out about Calvin College and moved here to wonderful Grand Rapids. And Dave Young, there's a few people in the crowd laughed because they know me. So Dave Young says, no, not so fast. And here's what Dave says in rejecting Warfield's claim. He says, if you read the biblical narrative, it's actually pretty clear that the people at the very beginning, and namely Adam and Eve's kids, Cain and Abel and others, it's pretty clear they lived in the Neolithic world. One of them was a shepherd, one of them was a farmer. Immediately after that ugly business with the whole murder thing, one of them ran off to a what? A city. Now, anthropologists can tell us when in human history these sorts of activities started to happen. Right about 7,000 to 10,000 years ago, and that number ought to sound really suspiciously familiar to you. That's the kind of number kicked around by our friends, the young Earth creationists, say the Earth is at most 10,000 years old. They're using the chronologies to get their number. Dave says, well, you know, if you look at the story, it sure looks like Adam and Eve and their kids lived in Neolithic times. They didn't live 120,000 years ago. There weren't any cities 120,000 years ago. So there's a problem. In other words, Dave Young would say, it's not so easy. So what should we do with this? I haven't even mentioned evolution. It only gets worse there, right? These accounts don't seem to fit together. What are our possibilities? One possibility is to state, oh, and by the way, I mean, we have two problems. One problem is the apparent reliance of our account on a single couple, on two human beings. That's a problem, because evolutionary theory would not predict that we all respond from a single couple of individuals. I should add parenthetically that if you are proposing that, you ought to be able to make predictions about the genetic difference that's arisen in human beings since then. You would have some very specific expectations about the genetic makeup of the human population today. And you wouldn't have to wait long to test those predictions. You could do it next week, perhaps. Anyway, so we have one problem. Two people, and then the second problem. is the timing just doesn't seem right. The Bible really does seem to put Adam and Eve and their kids in a particular point in history, far more recent than the fossil evidence shows that anatomically modern human beings have been on the planet. Possible approaches. First of all, well, sorry, Professor Usher, Archbishop Usher was right. Adam and Eve are recent ancestors, and there's something wrong with all those fossils and all that data and all that and so forth. And I think you can probably guess I'm not going to favor this particular solution to the problem. So the second option is, or the second set of options, is to consider Adam and Eve as representatives of humanity, either recent representatives, meaning that they really did live in Neolithic times, or as ancient representatives. The problems with this view are simply that it seems to solve your scientific problems, but it doesn't seem to make the story look any more easily lined up with what you know. In other words, it doesn't solve some of the, what you might call theological or narrative problems. Neither approach really works all that well there. I'm not going to tell you whether I like either one or both. I'm simply saying that Christians are thinking about this, have thought about it, and are still worrying about it. Perhaps non-Christians are too, by the way. I don't mean to simply claim that for Christendom. Of course, another possibility is to do what many of us have already done with respect to the earliest accounts in Genesis, in Genesis 1, about the creation of the world, and simply rethink whether that account ever meant to imply that it was telling a literal history about real people who lived in particular places and did particular things at particular times. And I recognize that this is difficult. This raises questions for Christians. Well, you know, the standard argument is a sort of domino argument. Well, if you give that one up, then what are you going to give up next, et cetera? And I guess the problem with making that beef about the rethinking proposal is that if you don't rethink Genesis 1, then apparently you think there was a time in Earth's history when an enormous crystalline bowl was over a big flat Earth, and the bowl had water of it, and that when it rained, windows opened and let the water through. That is the description of the early universe in the early chapters of Genesis. And many of us, I hope you'll agree, understandably, have concluded that's not a literal account of the cosmology of our universe. And that instead, someone was talking to someone else in language they could understand about God and what he did and what it meant. As I guess you can probably tell, I think we probably have to rethink these narratives to grab a hold of what they're really trying to tell us about God and us and who's to blame for what, rather than saying, well, you know, they must have lived somewhere near Haditha or maybe Abu Ghraib. Anyway, so I'm not sure any of that matters if our questions are about God and so forth. Okay, that brings me to intelligent design, and I guess I'm only going to have time to make a few comments here to whet your appetite and so forth. Let me to first tell you a little bit about what intelligent design is, and I'm going to acknowledge Ted Davis, a colleague at Messiah College, for, I think, very, very nicely helping me see what intelligent design, what this movement is. It's really two related and intertwined movements. One movement is what I'll call a political and social effort to oppose naturalism. Naturalism, the belief that protons, neutrons, electrons, the forces that act on them are the only things in the universe. A form of atheism, I suppose. And then the second sort of aspect of the intelligent design movement is a philosophical and intellectual, I'm going to deliberately not say scientific, effort to identify evidence of design in the natural world. Now, those two are not the same thing. In other words, this effort to oppose naturalism is not the same thing as trying to identify design in the natural world. The first one, opposing natural, includes a lot of really awful science, just awful stuff. Stuff that sounds hauntingly and disturbingly like the stuff in this book. Sort of propagandistic, selective quotation, things that look suspiciously like out-and-out duplicitous. Anyway, just kind of, there's a lot of yucky stuff there. The kind of ignorance, duplicity that we see in this piece of junk by the professor here. Those of you who weren't here last week didn't get to hear me say that his earlier work is utterly brilliant, some of the best science writing ever done. So, as I said last week, I think it's really sad that it's come to this, when where we started with some really great stuff. Anyway, so I'm not going to talk too much about that effort to oppose naturalism. I'm a Christian, so I'm all about opposing naturalism. If it's about opposing efforts to tell people that they're stupid for believing, for example, but there's not much there that's helpful with regard to science. The second thing, though, is this idea of trying to identify evidence for design. You know, and I think this is more interesting because, as you now know about me, I'm all about explanation. And when you start talking about design, you're at least in the neighborhood of talking about explanation. Maybe incorrectly, maybe disastrously incorrectly, but at least you're talking about explanation versus just bellyaching about who gets to run the Supreme Court or the school board in some place in Pennsylvania. So the basic premise of this aspect of intelligent design goes something like this. There are aspects of the natural world that could not possibly have arisen through random change. So there's two notions that these thinkers talk about when they're in this area. One of them is something called specified complexity. This is a mathematical demonstration, or at least so it's claimed, that there's complex information in nature that could not possibly have come about spontaneously. Big giant numbers like these tend to come up in the writings of these folks. The second is this concept of irreducible complexity. I mean, put up your hand if you've heard this phrase, irreducible complexity. So, about half of the hands. So, the basic idea of irreducible complexity is that scientists look at a structure in biology. Their favorite one is a little whip-like tail that's on the back of a bacterium that helps it swim around, find food, and get you sick. They look at that thing, and it's cool. It's got an electric motor that powers it. It's got all these cool structures. It's got a joint, a circular joint, and the thing turns like this. It looks like a motor, an outboard motor. It's cool. I barely know what that word outboard means. I'm from Arizona. But anyway, it looks like a little sort of propeller. It's cool. They look at it, and they say, it's irreducibly complex, meaning if I take any one of those parts out of it, it doesn't work anymore. You might say, well, yeah, duh. Well, the point is, wait, if natural selection had to act on some precursor to bring it into its current state, which is of this super cool outboard motor that helps bacteria swim around, well, then that precursor would have been worthless. I mean, in fact, worse than that, it would have been worthless, but taking up a lot of precious space. Like, hey, Steve, what is that? Well, it's half an outboard motor. What are you doing with it? Well, I'm thinking someday it's going to turn into an outboard motor. And in the meantime, I'm going to carry it around in my backpack, you know, every day, 24/7. Okay, you see the problem. It's an interesting challenge, don't you think? It is. So this is the idea of irreducible complexity. There are structures in cells, on cells, in the world that we just can't see, and that's a really important phrase I just chose there. I just can't see how they could have come about by random selection acting on variation, because I can't see how the precursors would have had any function at all. And therefore, they wouldn't have been there in the first place. Okay, first question. Doesn't that sound like the God of the Gaps to you? It should. Because it's awful close, right? Because the argument could be rephrased like this. I found something I can't explain, therefore... All right, well, I'm going to give you a surprising answer to your question. Isn't this the God of the Gaps? My answer is yes and no. Don't you hate when that's the answer? Oh, come on. You know, the emphasis on ignorance I really don't like, and when I get to my reasons why I don't like ID, then you'll see that. But you know, while much of the writing of intelligent design folks and their polemics, much of it is unmistakably God of the Gaps, the fact is many of the prominent intelligent design people, I said ID, and I'm referring to them when I say that, don't deny common descent. They say, oh, sure, common descent, no problem. Yeah, that thing came from common ancestors. They don't dispute that. They accept that explanation. They say simply, we just can't imagine that, or we can even prove that it can't be, that random mechanisms brought those things through those stages. So I'm not pointing at a gap in the fossil record, for example. But secondly, and more importantly, another of my heroes, maybe I should put up a website, Steve's Heroes or something. So, Del Ratch, a colleague of Kelly's and mine at Calvin, a philosopher, argues, in my view, compellingly, that It's simply not true that by saying that you have identified design, that you have therefore claimed that there is a gap. He tells this story. Suppose, remember the meteor crater thing last week? Right. Suppose a meteor shower, a really weird meteor shower, to hit the moon tomorrow. It obviously happens, right, because there's all these craters on the moon. Suppose it was weird. Scientists saw it coming and said, looks like a big meteor shower is coming towards the moon. So, okay, and then everyone looked through telescopes and the meteors all hit the moon. When the dust cleared, there was a message there, and it said, let's go with, listen to Kelly. Okay, now Dell says, Dell's example was, suppose it was an elaborate mathematical proof. That's just so geeky, I thought we'd go with something cool. Anyway, Dell said, now then, suppose that science was at such an advanced stage at that point that it could analyze that meteor shower and demonstrate beyond any reasonable doubt that every single meteor in it had never been acted on by any supernatural force, and in fact, all the particles in that meteor shower, their position at that moment in time would have been predicted at the moment of the Big Bang. I know that sounds preposterous, but philosophers get to do experiments like this. That's why scientists get real jealous sometimes when we talk about it. Dell says, do you really think that anyone would say, well, now we've explained it, so listen to Kelly, that doesn't mean anything at all. There's no design there. Of course not. We would all say, as I've been saying before, thank you for that explanation. There's design there, and all I need to do is point to it to identify it. Okay, so I think Dell's got a good point, and I hope maybe you agree with me. If we see design itself is something that we recognize and we want to talk about. We want an explanation. And if someone steps forward and says, well, there's no gaps that came before that, are you really going to fold up your tent and say, oh, well, okay, it wasn't design. It's just randomly spelled out. Listen to Kelly. Of course not. Okay, so that means, if you ask me then, that design actually is an interesting question. Some people who know me well are often surprised when they hear me say this and think I'm this militant against intelligent design. No, I'm not. I just think intelligent, of course I believe in intelligent design. I just don't rule out common descent or natural selection or any other natural explanation when I consider it. I think design is an interesting question. Intelligent design is often denounced as merely stealth creationism. This accusation is not without merit. Read the Dover trial if you want to know some of the very specific reasons why people think intelligent design is stealth creationism. But come on. Isn't design interesting? The answer to that question is, yes, it is. You see design all the time. You sometimes see evidence for it in your world. You probably typically attribute it to humans. You probably don't typically attribute it to, say, Martians. Or the people in that movie, Independence Day, wherever they came from. You probably typically don't do that. But there could be a time, folks, when we found something in the world where we'd say, well, random chance? No. And we would effortlessly discard that hypothesis. We'd say, was it Clark? No, he's not here. He lives in Grand Rapids, and we're on Mars. Oh. Well, and we might arrive at aliens. Point being, design is interesting. Yes, of course it's interesting. Why doesn't it work for me? Number one, this is probably just me talking about all my problems, maybe more than anything else. I just don't like any argument that goes like this. I don't see how X could happen through Y. Therefore, in other words, basing any kind of conclusion on what I don't know, I put in here a really important quote from Jerry Coyne that it's now famous. We've never made any progress by labeling our ignorance God. I don't see how X could happen. It's not generally thought to be a really good scientific argument. What it is a person honestly saying, yeah, we don't yet have an explanation for that. And I'm made nervous by Christians who get really excited when scientists talk about what they don't know. Woo-hoo-hoo! Aren't you excited about what we do know? No, that makes me kind of sad to think that all you care about is our ignorance. I just don't get excited about arguments based on what we don't know. And it seems to me intelligent design is about, I just don't see how this could happen. Therefore, and I just don't like it. Someday we'll figure it out. Then what are you going to say? Oh, okay, never mind. Second, those two big notions, which I didn't get, we don't have time to go into in detail, specified complexity and irreducible complexity, they sound pretty watertight. They're not. There's leaks, there's problems, there's all sorts of ways in which they've been composed that aren't so helpful. There's, for example, that favorite thing, that little motor on the back of the bacterium. Scientists have brought forth some really compelling evidence that, you know, maybe it's not even irreducibly complex the way you think it is. Maybe that at first seemingly irrefutable, seemingly cool response that you had is not so true. And maybe, you know, we can give an explanation if you just give us a little time and several hundred million dollars. Well, most importantly, like I said, I'm just uninterested in the kind of explanation that intelligent design seeks. It's either a God of the gaps, or if it's not, it's an explanation on a different level than the kind of explanation I'm seeking when I read about gravity or about embryonic development or about evolution. I'm not asking whether there's design. Of course there's design. I want to know what are the natural mechanisms behind it. When I see someone fall to Earth, my question is, well, what were they doing up there? What's going on, etc.? I'm looking for a different kind of explanation. And if someone says to me, because it was God's will, I'm going to say, maybe, but that wasn't the question I was asking. And that's my general response to intelligent design.
Well, because it's design.
Yeah, but anyway, that wasn't the question. All right, so that's the root of most of my recalcitrance on that idea. Finally, religion's net influence in human experience is evil. Now, why is this biologist talking about this and not the philosopher? Good question. Kelly, why am I? Here's what I thought I would say about that. That sounds like an empirical claim to me. It is, isn't it? I know it might be hard to measure, figure out. We'll have to come up with an evil meter. We'll have to quantify it, use the appropriate statistical analysis. We'll need a control group. I mean, I grant you that it's going to be difficult to answer this question, but this is an empirical question. Has religion had a net evil influence on our world? Professor Dawkins, you claim to be this scientific icon. It's all about the science. Great, so where's that evidence? You'll search in vain in this book for that evidence. What you'll find instead is actually really offensive. And I don't mean offensive because I'm offended because I'm a Christian and we're actually pretty good people. No, what I mean is, you thought I was going to fall for that? Richard, it's not so easy. I'd like to see the evidence. I am deeply suspicious of the transparently religious claims of Professor Dawkins. Among other things, he relies on guilt by association. Selective quotation, which is a favorite, by the way, of our propagandists that are typically acting against evolution. A lot of anti-evolution tracts are loaded with quotations ripped, irresponsibly out of context. The professor engages in that same tactic repeatedly in the so-called book. He is blind to the colossal hypocrisy of his attack, and let me just say that if Christians are complicit in evil that has been done by other Christians throughout the world, and actually as a Christian I'm willing to go there, then I wonder what Professor Dawkins is going to say if I ask him who are the record holders for genocide in the history of the world and upon what ideology did they work. He would protest, and if you're a skeptic here today, you should too. You should protest at the obnoxious guilt by association. The answer, by the way, would go something like this. That's not what atheists believe. That guy doesn't represent us. I'm talking about Stalin, if you don't know. And you'd be right. All right, so guilt by association is an obnoxious, dirty trick that Richard plays, and he should be ashamed. I have to admit, I'm suspicious that, as Hamlet's mother once said, the lady protests too much. That's my response to the so-called religion is evil argument in the God delusion. In any case, though, the last question for the professor is, how is that relevant to whether God exists? He himself claims it's not. He says, well, you know, this isn't really relevant, but then he just can't resist. And I would say, folks, watch for these kinds of dirty tricks. Whether you're reading a book attacking evolution, there's plenty of those, and there's lots of dirty tricks in them. Or reading a book attacking whatever candidates in whatever party you don't like that are running for the office that you care about. Or if you're reading this book attacking belief, watch for the dirty tricks. I'll end with my personal favorite. Francis Collins is the director of the Human Genome Project, former director of the Human Genome Project, has a different title now. You might remember 6 or 7 years ago there was this feud going on between Francis Collins and Craig Venter. There were these two competing visions for how this human genome sequencing thing should unfold. And there was supposedly a feud. By the way, they both deny it. They're like, we were competing. What? Give me a break. But anyway, two guys. One of them, Francis Collins, is an evangelical Christian who's written a book that I recommended last week. And the other one, Craig Venter, is an atheist. Richard Dawkins refers to Francis Collins as, quote, the administrative head of the Human Genome Project. And then goes on to laud the phenomenal work done by Craig Venter. I'll simply say that, please, I hope you're smart enough not to fall for tricks like that. And if you're wondering what I'm talking about, go look to see what are the scientific publications that have Francis Collins' name on them. You might want to limit yourself just to the last 12 months or so when you do that. Administrative head, give me a break. All right, so anyway, I'm done ranting, you'll be glad to know. And let me just end by saying, it's not that easy. Number one, if you're a believer, to simply say, what? Explanation, no problem. No, I didn't mean to say that. And as a skeptic, Richard Dawkins makes it look easy. It's not so easy to show that religion, for example, has been a net evil. Okay, I'm yammering too much. I'm going to stop and get some water. And then now we have a plan for taking questions, right?
Here's what I think we'll do. We'll start with somebody who would like to just raise a question out loud. But I'd also invite you to write down questions that you may have. And then if you pass them to the front, then we'll give them to the speakers. Okay, we'll start with some questions. So please, if you have a question that you'd like to write down, do that and then pass those to the front. In the meanwhile, Taya.
I guess here's the way I'd put it. And this is why why I think what we do is philosophy and not physics. Physics can go down to a certain point, and they make these extrapolations based on the physical constants that we know, and so you're making judgments based on what contemporary physics teaches is the best explanation in the world. And it takes you back to a certain point, but not back to the beginning. And so a physicist couldn't guess what was back there, because the only evidence that they have are the laws of contemporary physics. And so it takes you back to a certain point, and then you have to stop, and then it's just a mystery. And you're not doing physics anymore. And so when I say it's God, and I said it was God, I think you might have some reason to prefer God as the thing that created the point, but it's a reasoned guess. And the squeeze-bang hypothesis is suggesting that matter and energy probably or something like them are eternal. The physical laws are going to keep changing with every squeeze-bang, but they're eternal. But that's just a guess. But no one, none of us, is offering any hypotheses here as a scientist. So maybe it was God. I'm inclined to think it was. But even if matter and energy are eternal, here's the interesting thing. I think you could still make an argument for the existence of God, because you'd still have Aristotle, for example, thought the universe was eternal, but he thought there was a God that was the sustainer of this eternally existing universe, because he didn't think He thought it was so unique and design-like, he thought there had to be a God to explain it. And so I gave the argument as though there were a beginning, and if that fits better with the traditional way of understanding the biblical narrative, that there was a specific beginning in time. But there have been some Christian theologians who don't think that creation had to have been in time, that it's God. Creation is God constantly sustaining the universe. It's constant creation. And so even if the universe turned out to be eternal, you'd still have to ask, why does this eternally existing universe exist? Especially, you know, one like this that has human life in it. Why does that exist? I'm inclined to think even if there were an infinite number of spatio-temporally unconnected universes and we'd have scientific evidence for it, we might think God wanted everything. You know, I just don't see anything science is going to find where you'd get to a point and you'd think it still wouldn't be a question, why are there all of us, you know? Why would that happen? So even if science could find that something like that, to me, it wouldn't create a big problem for belief. Well, that's a question Dawkins asks, David Hume asks. There are many people that have asked that question. I guess you have to look... whenever you're looking for an explanation, you're looking for an explanation where you think you've understood something, where you've gained understanding, and you can stop. And then you have to ask, is this a good stopping place for your explanation? And it depends on the question. So if you were to go to Mars, for example, and you see this really elaborate structure there on Mars, and you thought, and it looked designed, and I think we do have cognitive faculties that are like design sniffers. You see it, and you see, we see design. And sometimes it's wrong, sometimes it's not. Like we might think crystalline spheres are designed when they might not be. They might be just like any other rock. But at any rate, you might go there and you might see this, and you ask, well, what created it? How did that get here? Sometimes we explain the existence of that thing in terms of something more complex than that thing. Dawkins always makes it look like you always want to explain the complex in terms of the simple. That's how Dawkins looks at it. And so if we had something simple, matter and energy, and then through this we could get something really complex, like Kenny, then we'd have the explanation of the complex by the simple. Sometimes we have to explain the complex by the complex. There might be a story where this Martian life unit or whatever it was, it's a structure, it's got windows, it's got a way to create water and food, beds and the like for people to, or evidently for people to sleep in. You look at that and you think, well, I want to understand that. There might be an explanation in terms of the simple, but we might have to explain that in terms of the more complex. We might think that there was some kind of extraterrestrial life that created that. And then we might go looking for it. And then that might be the end of the explanation for us. It depends. Well, we might want to know, well, who created them? Where did they come from? So my overall point is sometimes we explain the complex in terms of the simple, and sometimes we don't. Dawkins says we always explain the complex in terms of the simple. And it depends what we're trying to understand. Now, I can tell you how theists look at this, and it's a way that I find intellectually satisfying, and that's this. I see the universe, I see all these ways the universe could have been, including not. It didn't have to exist. The philosophers asked this question, why is there something rather than nothing? And that is a puzzle. Why is there something rather than nothing? And it leads some people... That question immediately leads some people to believe in God. You know, why is there something designed rather than nothing? Why are there human beings rather than... And then the list could go on and on. So why is there something rather than nothing? If there's a satisfying explanation of this whole thing, and science doesn't have one, whatever we think here, if it's just matter and energy that's existed eternally in its various manifestations, science isn't going to tell us this. Or if we think it's God, I'm inclined to think it's God. And I think the reason it's okay to stop with God is because, and we don't have to ask the who created God question, is because I think God exists differently from the way you and I exist. Like we're dependent beings, so we depend on food, oxygen, having had parents, love, you know, whatever, all the things we depend on, you take them away, and we don't exist. So we depend on things outside of ourselves for our existence. So we're dependent beings. And I think everything in the universe is a dependent being. It didn't have to be the way it was. Take away certain things, it'll cease existing. God, I think, is an independent being. He doesn't depend upon anything for his existence. And so there are lots of things that come together that explain our existence, but God's existence is different. God has everything within himself for his own existence. You might look at it this way. God contains all the resources for his own existence. In philosophers' terms, we say God exists of necessity. It's not possible for him not to have existed. He carries within himself his own resources for existing. He explains his own existence So the question, who created God, it's just a bizarre question. It's like, what color is the number 13? It's one that just doesn't apply. Now, I don't say that to persuade everybody to believe. I think this is a place where a lot of theists have found the quest for understanding to terminate in something satisfying. And a lot of atheists haven't. Yeah. All right, let me say it in the most simple way, then we'll go on to another question. Everything in the universe might not have existed, and it might not have existed because everything in the universe is the kind of thing that depends upon something else for its existence. And Christians think God isn't the kind of being that depends on something else for his existence. So there's nothing you can take away from God, and there's nothing that God needs to get so that he comes into existence. So the question, who created God, is a question that just that doesn't make sense. All right?
Back there. Go ahead.
Steve, will you get up here so people can think you're incoherent?
Trying to avoid having to answer any hard questions.
The first question is on design, and it's I just don't see the connection between that sort of the telos, the endpoint of Big Bang is humankind, because you can also say, well, bacteria that devours the human body can also be the endpoint. So you can see evil design, and then you would have to conclude that God is evil because you see this sort of absurdity of that works against human love, compassion. And just as you can say that human beings have capabilities that are not, I mean, just the definition of human being as a loving, a worshipful human being can also be capable of hate and things that are not good. And the second question is for Dr. Matheson, is like, what do you think... theology, if not unnatural creation, should be based on? Like, what is the starting point of thinking about God and sort of getting away from scientific discourse?
In the first case, I just looked at one piece of evidence for the existence of God. I did say that if you were going to make any judgments whatsoever, any judgments, you have to look at all the evidence. And so the problem of evil is a problem, and it's a problem that's a problem that counts against the existence of God. And theists need to say something about it if you're going to continue to believe in God. I think there are things to say that I've written about it and others have. I don't want to belabor it here, but you're right. It is a problem. It has to be. And all the evidence, if you're making a judgment based on the evidence, you have to look at all of it. And I looked on one little bit. I know I did that. Added religious experience, but you have to look at the things that count against. And the problem of evil is the big one that counts against. And so you have to have something to say about it. I think there are things to say, but it's a big problem.
So the question is, let me see if I have the question right, first of all. If we're not going to look at the natural world to learn about God or to start, then where would we look? Is that fair? So, first of all, I think I need to confess something in front of this crowd, and I think I'm being recorded, so this is potentially dangerous, but my faith as a Christian is completely pre-scientific. I love listening to the fine-tuning argument because I think it's interesting. It has never made an impact on my belief. I learned about it long after I came to faith. I offer you my faith without explanation. And in fact, as a Calvinist, and now I'm talking about that weird theologian from the 17th century, 16th century, whenever, long time ago. I attribute my faith to God's action himself. And I don't even try to explain it. I don't say, the reason I believe is because when I look at the bacterial flagellum, what I see is an electric motor that whips around and makes bacteria swim. And I don't, And so I'm going to struggle in answering your question. I'm going to do my best, but I guess I just need to say, if someone says to me, well, why do you believe? I don't know how I'm going to answer that question. Like, I have this feeling in my gut that it has nothing to do with me. And there's at least some people in this room who know what I'm talking about. And the other ones who don't, I apologize, and come up here and maybe shake my hand and feel me to see if I'm real, and maybe we'll make some progress there. So if not in the real world, where do we start in getting to know God? Well, in fact, many of the Christians in this room do believe that the first way you know that there is a God and a little bit about him is by looking at the natural world. So I hope I didn't give you the impression that I don't believe that you learn anything about God by looking at the natural world. The big proviso that a Christian would probably add to that is say, but watch it, because many aspects of the natural world, including the several hundred individual primates that are gathered here, have been influenced by evil and by sin and by things that God did not intend, by the fall. And so you yourself said, wow, dude, you could really screw up if you look at evil in the world and say, well, if we work backwards, that obviously means God is evil. No Christian believes that. And so that could be a problem. So I don't look at the world and say, well, because trees grow like that, that must mean God is kind of strong. That doesn't seem to work. And yet, you're right. Just because I'm physical, I have to understand God and relate to him through physical things that neuroscience tries to explain. I don't know if I mentioned this. I'm a neuroscientist. I hear his word being preached, I hear it through the tympanic membrane going like this and sending impulses to the temporal cortex. I mean, you know, I do experience God physically, and there's no getting around that. But did that make any sense at all? Be honest, because I'm trying to say precognitive is where these beliefs come from, but, you know, we do look at the natural world and learn some things about God.
So. Hi, Dr. Matheson. I think the question in intelligent design is whether or not it could have a place in science. And I think it could, in the sense that up until recently, biologists just tend to look at the world of biology through a non-teleological perspective. In other words, whatever came about without purpose. And thus, back in the early 70s, when we learned that most of our DNA was non-coding for protein, it was assumed by many biologists, if not most biologists, that that was junk and it had no real purpose. And it's only as we start to discover more and more that they said, well, maybe that's not quite correct. Maybe it actually does have some purpose. Had there been teleological biologists who had looked at that and said, it doesn't code for protein, therefore it probably has some other purpose, and it started with that premise, I think our research would have gone much further, much faster than it has at the present time. So I can see teleological perspective as having an important place in biology, which up until now, and probably into the near future at least, is being rejected by most biologists.
I'll simply respond by saying I certainly don't disagree that one ought to look at the natural world, and especially organisms, and ask, and actually biologists have always done this, what is that there for? And there's no rule against doing that. A scientist is not breaking any law, not even any of Richard Dawkins' laws, by looking at something on the back of a whale and asking, what is that there for? The claim that scientists saw non-coding DNA in the genome in the 70s and 80s and referred to all of it as junk is exaggerated. That's not true. Some did say, well, junk DNA. In general, scientists said, we don't know what it's doing. Oh, my gosh, that's a surprise. It's not true that, in general, we all looked at it and said, well, it must be junk because we thought it doesn't have a purpose. It is true that too much emphasis on the kind of thinking that Professor Dawkins engages in could cause you to miss interesting things about the natural world. I agree with that. But whether intelligent design type of thinking will make for more effective scientific investigation, I'm skeptical, but I'm willing to do purpose-driven thinking myself if I see something in the natural world. So anyway, I think it's overstated sometimes, that advantage. Jonathan Wells, by the way, is a scientist who wants to engage in this. He's written a whole article looking at a particular part of a cell saying, well, you know, the Darwinist wouldn't even think of this idea, but I propose, and I think he's overstating himself. A Darwinist has every right to look at a part of a cell and go, huh, I wonder what it does. I wonder what it's there for. That person, if they're an atheist, doesn't have to be claiming that an intelligent designer put it there and went, ha, see if they figure this one out. All he or she has to think is, I think it might be doing something. Jonathan Wells proposes, I think it's a turbine. That idea doesn't have any evidence to support it, but if it did, that would be great. You don't have to be an anti-Darwinist to think about turbines. Anyway, but you're right. Thinking about purpose can be helpful.
I don't know who this question should be addressed to, but I'll start out by saying that a quote by Tom Stoppard, who had one of his characters in a play say, it's the most fabulous time to be alive when everything we ever thought we knew is wrong. And what that makes me think of is the fact that we can make ourselves believe absolutely anything, and we've proven this to be true in psychological circles and in scientific circles, and we have been wrong a billion times. We can't predict anything. So what makes us think on any surface that we can possibly predict this?
That was definitely to you.
So, I don't know whether Tom Stoppard thinks that we should doubt every explanation that we or others have ever offered to us about various phenomena in the natural world. And all I'll say is, if you're asking scientists to be humble, then you should do that. And if you detect a lack of humility on my part, you should feel comfortable pointing that out. I think I would return to something I said about common descent last week, which is that it is a really successful explanation. That is not the same thing as saying that it's true. Right? And in fact, I can tell you how you might go about disproving it. There are numerous ways. The best one would be to find, as I think it was T.H. Huxley once said, he was Darwin's bulldog. Someone asked him, how could you disprove Darwin's theory? And he said, four words, I think, fossil rabbits in the Precambrian. That sounds like a bunch of jargon to you. It's really not. It's a fossil layer where there was no organized life of any kind, and that common descent predicts shouldn't contain any. And if you found rabbits there, you'd know there was something terribly wrong with your explanation. My point is, all any scientist can ever offer is what we think is an excellent explanation for what we've observed, whether it's a crater in north central Arizona, the presence of a cleft palate in a human neonate, or the presence of fossil rabbits not in the Precambrian. We're proposing an explanation, and we think it's a pretty good one. It's held up a long time, and it has, more importantly, embrace new data that it could not have anticipated, namely the molecular stuff that I talked about. And so we think it's a great explanation. Could we be wrong? Yeah. Have we been wrong before? Yes. Have I been wrong before? Perhaps several times in the last 30 seconds. Should we therefore proceed with humility? Yes. Should we proceed always telling ourselves we're always wrong, we're always wrong? That hasn't been my approach, and I guess that's all I can say.
Someone asked, are faith and the search for knowledge mutually exclusive? There are a lot of things wrapped up in that. Sometimes people assume faith means believing what you know ain't true, in which case it makes it difficult to put the two of them together. Others tend to oppose faith and reason. I tend not to. I tend to, and if you were here last week, you know that I think we have like a God faculty that produces belief in God. It's one of our reasonable belief-producing faculties. It's one like belief in other persons or belief in the past. It's a belief that human beings are hardwired with. And it produces in most people, throughout most times in human history, it's produced some sort of belief in God. I just view that as a kind of rational belief-producing faculty. Now, that's belief in God. I haven't said, and neither of us have said much in the last 2 weeks about Christian belief. That's a horse of a different color. I think in our tradition, most people have thought what justifies people's belief distinctly Christian beliefs is the Holy Spirit. It works in our minds and works with our minds and the like. That's been the view of our tradition. There are others, probably more closely aligned with the intelligent design tradition, who want to try to prove the truth of Christianity. And you might know Josh McDowell, Evidence That Demands a Verdict, and Lee Strobel, I think, is someone that is involved in this project. So there are lots of people that try to show that Christianity is supported by the evidence. And I wanted to say, in response to your second question to him, I don't in general think that most of us spend most of our time looking at all the evidence and then proportioning our religious beliefs to the evidence. I mean, that just isn't the way most of us work most of the time. You know, most people have jobs. They have things to get on with in life. Fortunately, we have cognitive faculties. We do the best we can trying to study this or that, given certain objections. So it's not my job to try to turn most people into philosophers, to act like you have to look at the evidence all the time for and against and this and that, and have your belief hang in the balance, waiting for the next proof. You know, if intelligent design fails, you think, oh my goodness, I got to go out and find another foundation for my faith. I think it's really interesting if there is evidence in support of our beliefs, and I think we should look for it. We more corporately than any of you qua individual. But here's a way to look at it. I think it's reasonable for most of us to believe that E equals MC squared. And I think it's reasonable not because any of us here, except maybe Mark, even knows what the evidence is, but that we're in a community where people have that evidence. And that's a good thing to be in. And I think there are people in the Christian community that have looked at some of this evidence and they're doing that part of the job for us. It's not like each person has to go out and constantly look at evidence and have their faith sort of hanging in the balance in the meantime. So the I say all that faith and knowledge needn't be mutually exclusive. I think the fact is, for most people throughout most of their lives, probably especially in this day and age, faith is going to have its ups and downs, right? And there are going to be people with really serious doubts. That's just part of the human condition. And if we could have these arguments that proved it all once and for all, you know, that'd be great. Most of us don't have them, and that's why our lives sometimes go where we have more faith at some times and less at others. It might be a good thing if we did have really sure and certain knowledge, but most of us, at least existentially, don't have that at certain periods of our lives, and then we have to learn how to live with it.
So, Jack, it's 8:30, and I was wondering, do you want to make an announcement about people being feeling free to use, you know, the restroom?
Feel free.
Come and go.
Want to go home? Have had enough of this? You're welcome to leave.
You won't offend me. My students do this all the time. Just get up and leave. I don't know, class. I have a question
here.
You want me to take this one now, Jack?
Yeah. Well, let's.
I was really misinformed. I thought this was going to be about the God delusion. So this question will seem really out of place, but it's really taken from the book, actually. So in the God delusion in chapter 3, Dawkins writes, "The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction, jealous and proud of it, petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, misogynist, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously benevolent bully." Okay, that's all one sentence. My question is, do Christians believe the Old Testament God is God the Father, or is this a different God who no one believes in anymore?
I want to make two comments. One has only to do with your preface, and my talk was on... No. You said you thought he was going to talk. We were going to talk about the book, but my whole thing was on what he calls the central argument of his book. I think it's chapter 4. So, okay. So, but we didn't have time to do the whole thing. So, I'm going to say this, what I think, and then Jack's going to tell us the truth about this. I view Revelation as progressive, and so I don't view every property ascribed to God in the Old Testament as one truly ascribed to God. And so almost all those properties that he ascribes to God in the Old Testament are ones that I personally don't ascribe to God. I think that the Hebrews learned a lot more about the divine nature, and those things became increasingly clear in Scripture, and you'll see it if you follow Scripture through. So those are properties that I don't ascribe to God, and I don't do it because I think revelation is progressive. And the same is true with how I interpret early chapters in Genesis. I think there's a lot of accommodation to human beings in Scripture, and in the early chapters of Genesis, I don't think there's the writers are trying to tell us really anything literally about the creation, maybe even about Adam and Eve. But something had to be communicated in certain ways about the divine nature. I told you Jack's going to tell us the truth here in a second, but my overall method is I think that we learn things about the moral character of God that become guides for judging things that happened earlier on. I don't have an infallible hermeneutic for figuring that all out, but I do think throughout Scripture we get a better sense of the divine morality, so to speak. And I think it even gets clearer in the New Testament, and we can use that to make judgments about what happened earlier on. No, I wouldn't throw it out, but I just think, Emily Dickinson says, tell the truth, but tell it slant, success and circuit lies. So she says, if you tell the truth all at once, everyone would be dazzled. And I just think God didn't tell all the truth about himself early on, and there was a lot of, there was a lot of people learning things about God where they didn't have all the truth, and there's a kind of human element where things get put into human stories, and the truth becomes clearer and clearer. So I don't throw the whole thing out, but it's not easy sometimes to go back and figure out what exactly you're supposed to believe in some of the older stories.
So when I can hear from Jack? Some of the speakers are waiting for an answer to these questions, too, if that's any...
I'm not a biblical scholar. I just have to do... I mean, if there are biblical scholars here that have things to say about this.
I mean, the question is extremely complicated because you take a passage like in the Exodus, the Deuteronomy... there are these passages where God is revealed as the one who is slow to anger, full of mercy, and all of that. And then you have those passages that you mentioned. And to square those is baffling. I think all of us eventually are pressed to the place where we say, if you want to know what this God is like, you must see him in the face of Jesus Christ, in his life and his death. Those specific passages where we say I don't understand this, but it's not like the whole Old Testament is full of these barbaric pictures that you just gave. It simply isn't. It's sprinkled, and so what you'd have to do. No, I'm not saying we throw them out, but you would certainly have to take each specific instance and say, now, what's going on here? How do we understand this? And then we must always understand it, I think, in the larger truth. I mean, we have, you know, we've always said that we must understand the specific, or the one text within the context of the whole Scriptures. And finally, we must look at those texts in the light of what we have discovered in the final revelation in Jesus Christ. It is. Well, I mean, you know, this is a question that we could spend the whole evening on, and I'm certainly not wanting to do that tonight.
If we decide to spend an evening on that, I would come. So,
well, you know,
and sit in the audience.
We should. I've thought about, you know, because I knew that Dawkins says these sorts of things, and I did think that that is an issue that the church needs to struggle with. And I was hoping that maybe some Old Testament professor from the seminary would be here, so we could ask them. Finally, you do in the scriptures. There are places where you say, I don't quite understand this, and so you put it to the side, and you say, later on, I may find somebody who does know how to handle this command. But I may in the end finally say, you know, I think those who said this was the Lord's will were wrong. They interpreted it to be the Lord's will, but it wasn't the Lord's will. And that would not trouble me in the end. Well, you decide by what I think is the common understanding of the Christian community that ultimately we must say about God what we find in Jesus Christ. And so if in the end we cannot square something with what we have found in Jesus Christ, then we will just say, you know, I'll give God the benefit of the doubt. There must be some explanation here that I don't understand. I mean, and so you move on. But you don't throw the whole thing out because there are these specific things that are extremely troublesome or difficult. Anyway, let's do this again. We'll get a couple of Old Testament professors here and a couple of theologians, and we'll talk about this some more.
It's not a stupid question. I hope you didn't hear anyone say that. I sure don't think that's a stupid question.
Oh, no, it's a difficult question.
Yeah, it's a good one.
And you had something.
This is a question on a little bit lighter note here. It's kind of directed to Dr. Clark there. You made kind of just a quick comment that your reasons for belief in God aren't God of the gaps. And I was just kind of curious if you could kind of give some waypoints for how you know if a belief is in a potentially fillable gap or if it's beyond the realm of science. Like, for instance, with your singularity example, physics can't go back that far, but potentially something else could. So, yeah, any comments on how we have any idea of what might be fillable in the future, and if so, how you can believe something that will never be filled?
Yeah. I don't know that. I mean, in general, I think the question is, why is there... Really, this question is, why is there something rather than nothing? Or why do we live in a universe that has... human beings are being capable of worship and the like. And there's, as Steve pointed out last time, there are lots of explanations. I mean, there can be a scientific explanation for why are there creatures like us. And that explanation need not compete with what is a really seriously teleological question. For what purpose? Were we created for a purpose? And I take it that science has nothing to say about, and biology is not looking for that kind of purpose. So, to my best lights, these don't look like God of the Gaps arguments. They could turn out to be. I mean, it may turn out that we do find something that gives us knowledge about something we thought was in principle not knowable through science. So I don't have a method for figuring out when we don't have one, when we do have one. But it looks to me like these things are things that are beyond the domain of science. And part of the point I wanted to make is when Dawkins speaks about this and others, he's not speaking as a scientist, even though it looks like a lot of science. And I wasn't speaking as a scientist, even though there's a lot of science in it. Both of us were speaking as philosophers and trying to do our best to figure out why do we live in a world like this one?
Okay. I think it's getting late. We'll have one more question. Who? One in the back.
Yeah, I was telling him, I addressed it because Dawkins says this is the central argument of the book. And so I'm responding to what he takes to be the central argument of the book. And he tries to argue that it's just that it's a coincidence and it's not very improbable. And he uses probability figures that are really skewed and they're skewed in his favor, and they're just wrong. They're obviously wrong. And so he tries to argue. I'll tell you one thing that he says. He says, there's a version of what I said where someone acts like there's nothing here to be explained. And it goes like this. We don't have to explain the existence of human beings, because if we didn't exist, we wouldn't be here to ask the question. Okay? And in a sense, they're trying to explain it away. And a philosopher is given this example. Suppose you're there's a firing squad, and you're the victim. There's 10 people in the firing squad, and they all shoot, and you're alive. Now, it's true that if you weren't alive, you wouldn't be here to ask the question. But there's still something that needs to be explained. Why are you alive? And why you're alive probably has something to do with the intentions of the people that shot you. Either all the rifles were bad or they all didn't want to kill you. And what he's trying to do is preclude asking the question, he's trying to make it not an interesting question to ask by saying, he's trying to trivialize the question. And I don't think it's a question that can be trivialized. I think it's really significant that we're here and we're alive. So I think it's a question that should be asked. Why are we here and alive? And so that's one way he tries to stall the question. And then the other is the question that the man raised earlier. He asked, who created God? That's the other question. And I tried to respond to him. I think Christians or theists have something to say about that. I think it's a kind of childish question, who created God? I think God, if God exists necessarily or eternally, and wasn't created. He's just not the kind of being that's created. And I think God is a legitimate explanation for the existence of this. But that's the central argument of his book. He says it's the central argument. And to me, Steve raises the moral question. He keeps saying over and over again, I'm not going to talk about morality. I'm not going to talk about meaning of life, in part because theism is much better with respect to morality and the meaning of life. Theism is a better grounding for morality than evolution. And God is a better grounding for morality, for the meaning of life than evolution. So he doesn't want to bring those in. He thinks they're not really relevant to the truth. But then he keeps bringing in all these moral things. But the central argument is one argument in the book, and it's on this what's called the anthropic principle, the fine-tuning argument.
Say also, by the way, in 10 years ago, it was Dan Dennett who wrote a book called Darwin's Dangerous Idea. And in that book, he definitely discusses fine-tuning and then embraces the many-worlds hypothesis and even says, well, if you, speaking to his readers, were, you know, terrified by this fine-tuning thing, well, at least now you have a nice argument. And he talks about Lee Smolin's ideas of perhaps new universes being born in black holes. And so Dennett especially 10 years ago really outlined this fine-tuning and many worlds thing, and simply said, this is your answer if you're an atheist in many worlds, because otherwise, yeah, this is a tough one.
Okay, folks, I think we should come to a close.
I feel like I've had a workout.
We want to thank you for coming and enjoy the rest of Mother's Day.